welcome back to yet another episode of Behind the Lens. I am we've been looking forward to this one for so long because he's back, boys and girls.
Oh, gosh.
The one and only sound guy, designer, FX guy, and founder of the Hollywood Sound Museum. The one and only Steve Lee is here.
Hi.
Welcome.
How are you? You build me up so much. I don't quite know how to.
Yeah, I know. I know. Hire me as your publisher.
I appreciate it.
Hire
me exactly. As your publisher. Hey, the museum might need someone. That'd be cool.
But this is so exciting. We had so much fun last time you were here. To this day, it is still the only 90-minute show
we had.
We ran an extra half hour long.
It's a surprise to me as much as it was to everyone else. But that's fine. Let's see if we do it again today. We might do it. Let's not commit yet.
No.
But
we have so much stuff here again because all of our regular listeners know we've talked about it before. You know, the guys from Formosa have been on here before. Academy Award winners, you know, Scott Hecker, Mark Mangini. I've done one-on-ones with Mark Stechinger, Tim Hoganocker. They've all been in studio.
Mm-hmm.
And each one who really has a different discipline when it comes to sound.
Yeah, it's interesting. Everybody has their own different approach, but it's all about the storytelling regardless. It's like we're all telling a story. Everybody has their own sort of, you know, methodology about it, and they're all fascinating. And it's fun to learn the history of all the way they work. But ultimately, we're serving the story. If everything's coming together, we're helping the tell the dramatic part of the tale you are witnessing.
And you know, and I love that lead in, that build up you just did. So whenever Pam comes back, you know, I just interviewed William H. Macy.
Oh, right.
Last week about his new film, Crystal. It's his third directorial.
Right.
I loved his first one, Rudderless. Was amazing.
He's a brilliant guy.
He really is. And he is very gifted at storytelling. You know, his mentor, be it acting, be it directing, is Dave Mamet.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
I mean, he constantly refers back to things that Mamet has told him to do over the years. And the best way to approach certain things.
Sure.
And he implements that. And with this movie, Crystal, I mean, it's written by Will Aldiss, set in the South, in Georgia. He actually acts in the film as well, opposite his wife, Felicity Huffman.
I love her.
And, you know, then he's got Rosario Dawson, Nick Robinson, who everybody is just falling in love with if they didn't get enough of him in Jurassic World. Love, Simon, which is just eating up the box office.
Right.
Of course, and the incomparable Kathy Bates.
Oh, yeah. She's always brilliant.
And William Fichtner, who has one of the funniest roles that I've ever seen him do. But, you know, it's interesting. Talking to Bill about the film, he was surprised with this outing, how much he can do with sound and how important sound is.
Absolutely.
And we talked about overlapping. So I'm going to have Pam play the clip of my interview with Bill talking about overlapping, and then I'll let you talk about what that is and explain the importance of it to everybody.
Oh, gosh. Okay.
And then we get to see you and Felicity just having a blast.
We really did.
That scene, the dinner scene, and no holds barred. And here's where your sound design came in, where your sound guys, because everybody's talking on top of everybody. Everything is crashing. Stuff is sliding. We hear all of it.
Yeah.
Nothing is muffled.
Yeah. I love overlaps. I love them in film. They are very, very effective. And you talk about, you said, does it get easier? I have been learning. And this time, the big revelation to me, God, filmmakers are going to listen to me and think how naive he is, but you can do more with sound design than I thought. You can really change the tone of a scene. You can change the import of a scene. I worked on the sound a lot, and I was amazed with what these technicians were able to do. Same thing with the color timing. Who knew? You can make a huge difference in a scene.
You're absolutely right on the issue of sound design, color timing. Things can, you can enhance, you can correct, you can also screw it up.
Yeah. Also, I'm late learning this in my career, but I'm a big dialogue guy. What did the writer write? And when it's scintillating, it's lovely. It's like your favorite song. I run into any other actor who's ever done American Buffalo, and we'll start riffing the lines because mm-hmm. they literally feel good to say.
Yeah.
They're so funny and so alliterative and musical. I've come to the conclusion it doesn't really matter in a film what people are saying. It doesn't matter that much. So this whole thing of overlapping, mm-hmm. it adds verisimilitude. And you're right. If you're cagey, you can get all the information out. It sounds like a cacophony, but all the points you had to make,
it's all there. It's like listening to a great, like Mark Steckinger did the sound design on John Wick 2.
Right.
And you can hear those guys at Formosa. I know so many of them. But Mark has it down to, you yeah. can hear each individual caliber type mm-hmm. of bullet in the middle of a massive gunfight with 16 guns.
Yeah.
And that just adds, you don't think about it.
You don't
think
about it, yeah.
And that's
all of this stuff the audience doesn't
here.
Know anything about. It's a grand illusion, and we love it, don't we?
And yes,
that's great.
We certainly do love the grand illusion. So, you know, overlap, and this is what I love about Bill and other directors who pay attention, and they're sound people.
Yeah.
You know, the supervising sound editor on Crystal is Brian Parker. Mm-hmm. And you hear there are 5 and 6 people in the room, and everything is overlapping, but you can hear the dialogue, you hear dishes crashing, you hear tablecloths.
Yeah. Well, that's a very, it's very orchestrative and very, it's you're going across all the different disciplines of sound because, you know, you have the production mixer on the set recording the dialogue. You have certain amounts of it that need to be replaced, which in a scene like that where you're bringing up certain people, you might need to do so that you have them clean. And then you have all the elements that you're integrating. You know, It can be intimidating for a mixer to try to make sense of all this material. As Randy Tom once says, the first day on a mix is usually a lot of people pulling out their hair and storming out of the room because you get it all together and it just sounds like a mess. And you have to start weeding through what you need to tell the story. I remember a moment on Goofy Movie where Goofy and his son are on this car that's in the middle of this fierce river that's like throwing them every which way, and they have this intense dialogue scene as it's going down. They're yelling at each other why they did the certain things they did over the course of the film. And I remember Kevin Lima, the director, being very into the dialogue and saying, you know, I don't mind if we lose this line or this line or this line, but as long as we push this part of the story and this, you know, you start working together to create the points that you need to express to get the story across. And sometimes you can just throw something away, mm-hmm. and it might be picked up subliminally. I remember Walt Disney talking about Pirates of the Caribbean when he went through the first time, and there were all these, you know, animatronics talking and all these story points, and, you know, and all the Imagineers were terrified that, you know, Walt's going to hate this. Walt isn't going to like this because it's just a mess. And he said, no, no, no. It's like going to a cocktail party. You know, you hear some people talking about something here, you hear something. It's interesting. It's you find what you want to listen to. And that's orchestrating that is really a challenge. So,
yeah, and I do know there are quite a few directors, and when you watch their films, they never have overlapping. It's like one line will finish,
yeah.
then another line starts. Yeah. But
even in like a Howard Hawks comedy where the dialogue is bam, 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 it's one person talking, one person talking, one person talking.
You know, think about His Girl Friday.
Yeah, exactly.
With Roz Russell and Cary Grant.
Exactly.
And nobody is stepping on anybody else.
Yeah.
But it is so much more natural, especially when you have a dysfunctional family dispute going on in a dining room at a dinner table with bodies sailing across, the table. And the tablecloth is going and the crystal is going.
I'll need to see this. It sounds fascinating.
It just opened on Friday.
Okay.
And it's really good.
Great.
And what Bill does is the dialogue, it's very loquacious. It's very, we don't hear this kind of dialogue much in film.
Right.
Has a theatricality to it. And there are some heavy themes and darker themes, but he keeps the film so light. Adam Silver is his DP. Mm. Adam Silver did Fort Bliss a few years ago, and I love what he did with that. But he also did Heathers, the TV show Heathers.
Okay.
So it's the dark and light, but they keep the visual tone very light. which also allows for this great play with the sound design.
Sure.
And yes, you need to see it.
I would love to.
That sounds great.
I'm a big fan of Bill's, and he's got a great sensibility, and everything he said, you know, is absolutely right. And it's nice to be able to work with a filmmaker that wants to learn the process. Sometimes they're very shut off about it, or they have a very, you know, know-it-all kind of attitude, and they have this wall toward learning something new. I mean, I've worked with, you know, some directors who've been very difficult to, you know, just won't learn the process and nitpick everything, and they don't understand why you're doing what you're doing, but they still have a say about it.
Mm-hmm.
And rather than work with you and learn the reasons for what we do and how we do it and what we can do to convey the story more, it's, you know, it's very helpful. Very early on, too, while you're shooting it, while you're thinking about it. I mean, you're talking about, you know, all these people talking. Once another example comes to mind, our dear friend Richard Anderson, who called in last time I was on the show, he supervised Goonies. And you have all those kids talking at once.
And in a cave, no less.
Yeah, and in a cave. So that was a tremendous, you know, mixing challenge. One of the dialogue editors, a guy named Andy Patterson, who's a brilliant guy, said that the foreigns on Goonies were brilliant because each one of those kids was looped by a different foreign actor. And so they were all on separate channels, so they could pan the dialogue if they wanted to. And that made more, you could still discern dialogue from people.
Wow.
It's harder when it's all together, you know, it's all recorded at once. Mm. So, you know, there's certain things you can do to make that more readable.
But there, so now everybody has learned about what overlapping is. So I'd love to see more first time, you know, and, you know, one or two films in filmmakers, you know, apply some of the things. Something else people can apply are going to be some of the sound effects that we're going to talk about here again. Steve, of course, brought us some of the sound effects that you all know and love, but he knows the story behind them all.
Yeah.
And, you know, for those of you that are listening, you know, if you hop on Facebook, the AdrenalineRadio.com Facebook page.
We're streaming right now.
And as usual, and plus we're doing a two-camera video shoot that'll be, you know, in post and out there.
It'll be on YouTube later, yeah.
Yes, it will, and on BehindTheLensOnline.net.
Right. That's right. Get your plug in.
But... I try, you know.
We're shameless here. Yeah.
Well, half the time I forget about me, you know.
You gotta do it.
But, no, so you'll get to see that. But you'll also get to see the accoutrements. We have several special accoutrements
today. I always treat these as show and tell. So I always bring something for the people that actually are watching, that can actually see picture and on Facebook and all that. Brought a few treats to actually show them. The radio people will just have to listen to our descriptions.
They will have to wait to see the video.
Yes. Make an effort, please.
But, you know, on the AdrenalineRadio.com Facebook page, you can go back and you can watch.
It'll be archived, yeah.
Yeah, it'll be archived, so you can see it again.
Well, you might have seen me fuddling with my phone a moment ago.
I did the same thing.
I shared it to my personal page and the Hollywood Sound Museum Facebook page. So hopefully some of you people are out there watching right now.
Well, you know, let's talk about Hollywood Sound Museum.
Let's do that.
This is still, we're still in the stages, but it's
still very slow.
So close.
Yeah, it's very slow going. Because it's essentially me and a couple of other helpers. We're right on the verge of our nonprofit status. That takes forever to do, but we're right there. We are gathering some amazing things for the museum and getting pledges of support from some fantastic people. What we really need is donations, and we're going to start really, you know, a drive for funding, because that's terribly important to make sure that we get all this done. And we're going to have a few very special fundraisers coming up, which I can't really talk about yet. I was hoping I would have more solidified by the time of the show. But
it just means you have to come back again.
I will come back again. That's fine with me. I enjoy it.
I love having you here, Steve, but because you're such a wealth of knowledge, a wealth of film history. And, of course, this is also a perfect week to have you because next week is the TCM Classic Film Festival.
Right. I love those guys. I know a lot of people involved with those things. Yeah.
Ben Burtt will be speaking. He will be introducing and speaking at a special screening of Cecil B. DeMille's The Ten Commandments with Charlton Heston.
Yeah.
And that will be in the Chinese Theater.
Which is marvelous. I love Ben. Ben is my hero and mentor. We've been corresponding for years now, and he's a great guy. You know, he of course did all the Star Wars sound effects, which are just absolutely brilliant. And yeah, and he's doing all these filmed pieces for TCM too.
Yeah.
That you might have seen.
Yeah, one of them that he did that I was telling you about before the show that I caught that I just loved, mm-hmm. talking about Robin Hood Arrows.
Well, that's one of his favorite films. It's one of mine too.
It's one of his
top five favorite films, I think, of Ben's. And I'm sure the piece was about the arrows that are heard in the film, heard and seen, which have a marvelous sort of zinging sound. And I can actually play you the sound effect.
See how we just segue into that?
And Pam is already working on it, but I will tell you that it is number 44. This has been sort of a puzzler for Ben for many, many years. He tried to figure out exactly how these arrows, which are essentially frictionless, mm-hmm. so they could travel so fast, how are they making a sound?
In that 1938 Robin Hood film.
Yes, exactly.
Which, that is the seminal arrow sound.
Well, this is actually off the optical master of those sound effects. Mm-hmm. So you're going to hear a few, you know, optical crackle and pops and stuff like that. It's an old recording. But they're still pretty fresh. I mean, we've used these before. But Ben managed to find the exact cut of the arrow with the feathers. It was a very specific kind of arrow. I don't remember exactly.
Yeah,
because I just saw the piece
on TCM.
Yeah, he does this lovely piece. If you watch, you'll probably catch it. It's, you know, bumpers between films, and it's just great. And it's great to hear him talk about this sort of thing. But he tracked down this arrow, and I went to a screening of Robin Hood at the Academy a few years ago, and he actually had an archer shooting arrows over the heads of the audience into bales of hay on the stage, and you could hear them zooming by. It's just a wonderful musical kind of. Go ahead and play that, Pam. It's this great sort of zingy. Yeah. They just sing. They just, yeah.
I know.
Yeah. You can hear the little optical pops between each edit, because that's how they did it back then. But we've used these out of the box. I mean, yeah. Ben has these wonderful, pristine recordings of them, but we've used these. There they are, hitting a target. It's all in how you mic them. You can mic them for a pass-by, or you can mic them for hitting the target. And you hear the room that it's in. It's obviously a stage somewhere.
Right.
Yeah, there you go. That's such a great sound. Yeah, that's one of my favorites. The darts in the beginning of Raiders have a very similar quality to that. Mm-hmm. I'm sure he snuck a few of those. Every now and then I'll watch a movie that he did, like one of the later Star Wars films or something like that, and I will catch an old Warner Brothers sound effect or something like that he just sneaks in, just puts in a little taste.
Hey, you know, if it works, if it ain't broke, don't fix it.
No, absolutely. No, it's great. It's great. I mean, we've all heard about Wilhelm, of course. That's an extreme case. But some of the, like, alarm klaxons and things like that for, you know, when all hell breaks loose on a ship, he'll use a couple of those, or, you know, different cartoon sound effects, mm-hmm. that the wonderful Treg Brown did, who did all the cartoon effects for Warner Brothers. Yeah, it's there's some classics that just fit for the gag. So you got to go there.
Well, of course. And, you know, with the plethora of sound effects you have brought today.
That's such a great word.
Isn't it? Because, you know, stay tuned, because I think at the halfway point of the show, in another about 11, 12 minutes, we're going to have a big reveal.
Yes.
We're gonna wait till, you know.
Yes, we will do that.
We're gonna do a big reveal. But in the meantime, how about some more effects, or talk about some of these other lovely show and tell items you brought?
Yes.
He did not bring the RoboCop foot sound effect again.
I did not.
Because that's like almost falling apart. When you had it on your kitchen table for.
Yeah, it was getting a little old. But I did bring some. This is a trim box for those of you watching visually. Film used to be kept in these things, and you used to have racks and racks and racks of these on the shelf.
And of course, you can all see it as an MGM.
Yeah. Those were the best ones. They had the lion on them, they had Leo there.
You got Leo. Yeah. You can't go wrong.
But what's in here is some actual prints on magnetic film of various sound effects. Speaking of Warner Brothers, there's the Roadrunner tongue. It's just, these are just prints of, you used to transfer them to film, magnetic film, and then cut them in sync to the picture. So you had hundreds of little rolls on your bench of all these sound effects that you'd have to cut each one. You listen to it, you roll down and listen to the piece you want, cut it out, and cut it into these big units of sound that would all be put together on machines that were synchronized to the picture, and then you'd combine them all. Now it's just a click of a computer. But back then it was really something to see all these machines running in unison. But these are some of the... this is the machine gun, the ricochets from Raiders of the Lost Ark of the Schmeisser, the German machine gun.
Aha!
What else do we have here?
And for me, this is like being a kid in a candy store, yeah, because I grew up with all of this stuff.
Yeah.
You know, from...
Yeah, we all worked on film.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's, you know, yeah, my dad, you know, and you're going to get some of... Steve is going to get for the museum some of my father's relics from the 1940s and 50s.
Thank you so much. That's going to be great. Here's one you can read that description there, because I refuse.
Wilhelm, man eaten by alligators. Short screams, 6 times. Light optical noise. Yeah. Okay, could really use this sometimes. Ah, oh, darn.
And these are all mono. These are all mag stripe. It's like there's just one channel of sound on this, but they're two, if you look on them, they're two stripes of mag on there, but they only recorded sound onto one. The other is a balanced stripe,
mm-hmm,
so that it wouldn't, like, you know, bunch up on one side. You know, when you, like, you stack magazines and it starts going this
curling,
way.
Because, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Uh-huh. So that's why that's there. But this is full coat. You could put stereo or 4-track or 6-track
anything
on this. Yeah. Oh, it looks like we have a phone call. I wonder who that could be.
I don't know.
Well, she'll have to wait on hold and listen to us for a little bit.
Well, and Pam is going to, will let us know.
Pam will let us know who it is, yeah. I was just, if it's who I think it is, yep, sure enough. I was actually just texting her because she was trying to log in to listen to our show, and I finally just told her, just call it.
Well, would you like me to bring her live?
I'll introduce this wonderful person.
Okay, well, let me, should I bring her live first?
Absolutely, okay. Do whatever you want.
Well, here we go.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is my dear friend Lisa Udall, who is actually one of my co-conspirators bringing you the Hollywood Sound Museum. I've known her for many, many years. Lisa, how are ya?
Hey, Steve, I'm doing okay. And yourself?
I'm doing fine. We're just here talking about sound effects.
Hi, Lisa. Welcome to
Behind... Meet Debbie.
Well, hey there, Debbie.
Hello there. Welcome.
I would very much like to hear Steve's logical information regarding the old school of filmmaking and the new film of filmmaking.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah.
Well, you know, we were just talking about Meg.
There's definitely a camp for each one.
We were just
talking. There's a camp for each one.
I just brought a trim box of Mag, and I was just explaining the whole process of rows and rows of Mag units going down the hall, and how it's now just a click of a mouse to generate more material.
Yeah, it used to be great weight work. Yeah. I mean, you know, lifting those 10-pound reels, it was great. You could get great ad. Yeah.
Well,
can't do that anymore.
But let me give you a proper introduction, Lisa Udall. Her late husband was the great David Udall, who was a brilliant sound editor who I've worked with off and on. The Thing, Christine, so many great films. And Lisa has graciously given us access to his collection for the museum, which is some marvelous stuff. I've been a huge fan of his work, and got to cut sound with him on several projects, including Fifth Element. And what else was he on? What other
Fifth Element sound is absolutely incredible.
Well, Mark Mangini was the supervisor, but he had a team of editors with David and a bunch of others. And what were some of the other? List his credits,
Starship
please.
Troopers.
Oh, Starship Troopers. Yeah, he did that with Steve Flick. Yeah.
He also did Once Upon a Forest and Lion King 2, believe it or not.
Oh, there you go.
Oh, my.
Yeah, he worked a lot with David Stone, who is a dear friend of mine also, Oscar winner for Dracula, Francis Ford Coppola's Dracula.
When they did Twilight Zone, the movie, they actually got the Warner Brothers cartoon library.
They were the first to break that wall, as I remember, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yes, that's correct. They
were under the Warner Brothers roof permanently until then, and... He did, Twilight Zone was a big Spielberg film, and mm-hmm. he basically broke down that wall for David to get. I remember David actually telling me that the guy that he went to, the librarian, was like, you know, clutching the box and wouldn't let it go.
I have to need him. I know.
Yeah, yeah.
Believe
exactly.
it. It's like a Warner Brothers cartoon in itself. Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Lisa, I'm curious, how exciting is it for you that, you know, all of David's work and, you know, his colleagues and peers over the years, how exciting is it that all of that is now actually going to have a home and to be showcased so that people can finally learn about the sound guys? So often people, when you go to the movies, people don't think about the sound. They don't think about the guys that are creating, you know, Indiana Jones whip sound or a Robin Hood arrow or a ray gun or a Darth Vader sound. But they become such a part of the zeitgeist and of our collective consciousness that now people will actually be able to get to learn. That has to mean a lot to you, that David's legacy will continue.
Well, oddly enough, it will continue and has, not only with his actual work that he did, but also with the book that he wrote called The Practical Art of Motion Picture Sound,
yes.
which is what brought us here to Winston-Salem, North Carolina. But, the goal of doing sound effects, editing, dialogue, Foley, and ADR, as well as music, is to the biggest thank you can have is nobody notices anything because it sounds
yeah,
perfectly logical
yeah.
and reasonable for film.
One of the invisible arts. Yeah.
The other thing is, just like actors and actresses get pigeonholed into different roles, sound editors get that same problem too.
Oh yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that's why David always liked to say, you know, I can also do animation besides the hard stuff because sound is sound,
yeah.
just like acting. You know, you got different sides for actors, but sound effects editors can also get pigeonholed. So having a lot of these things there, and a number of effects David created for himself, and were in numbers of movies, it's just nice. And to find out little things that were paid homage to with sound effects that some actors put in, or editors put in. You know, we all have our little behind-the-scene jokes, and that's part of the fun, too. And like when you said Fifth Element, the one thing in regards to Fifth Element, if anybody remembers the scene with Bruce Willis in his apartment,
mm-hmm.
there was a pussycat there.
Yes.
And David took our pussycat at the time
oh.
and
oh.
stuck him in a darkened room and recorded him for a couple hours, and that's our little pussycat
oh.
talking
oh.
back to Bruce Willis.
I've put my cat in a few films, too. That's always very sweet.
Oh.
Yeah.
yeah, it's always nice.
So,
when you
I mean, a lot of
yeah.
things have happened.
Yeah.
I mean, those are the kind of things that are fun to know. Just
mm-hmm.
like, yeah. oh, my gosh, there's a bus in the back of Ben-Hur. You know, that kind of thing. you know, those kind of crazy things. You know, people look for them.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
they also like to hear the fun stuff.
Yeah.
So.
That's what we aim
yeah,
to do is get all those stories uh-huh. told and archived and shared with in context.
So they're there
the
for the people in the future.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I just think it's fabulous because I am as Steve knows, I'm such a believer in preserving the past. And my dad, mm-hmm. after 60 years in broadcast television, going back to the 40s. Up until his passing,
mm-hmm.
he had a mantra. You had to understand where we came from to know where we are now and where we're going in the future.
Well, that's the thing. It's like what Lisa was asking me initially. With digital, it's so easy to just go and buy the equipment off the shelf and buy a sound effects library, all these just generic sounds. And nowadays, those wonderful Warner Brothers sounds, the Disney Library, Hanna-Barbera, they're all mixed together, and they're
mm-hmm.
just funny sounds now. But if you learn the context, you learn how they were made, it helps you inspire yourself to create more things, and
mm-hmm.
you know, you learn the history, and it helps you move ahead.
Yeah, well, that's like when Scott Hecker...
And also to understand the sound that was put to it. I remember David taking a recording of a foot in gravel, and he turned that into telemetric equipment in Philadelphia Experiment 1 and 2.
Oh, wow.
And he could get 50 sound effects out of one little sound.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, you had to be very inventive.
Well, you know, it's like when Scott Hecker was on the show and he talked about, you know, in the Empire Strikes Back.
Oh yeah.
Star Wars, mm-hmm. and the sound of Chewbacca slogging through snow was actually his body being drugged through a whole trough of raw eggs.
Because it had the right consistency.
It had the consistency. Yeah. So two guys were dragging his body through this slog of raw eggs to create the sound of Chewbacca slogging in snow.
Yeah. It's those kind of tricks that you learn from studying the history and figuring out how things are done and try to put a new spin on them.
Yeah. Well, and didn't Gene Kelly for the Singing in the Rain shot take a couple weeks to decide that it was sponges on his shoes to redo the Foley for that song?
Yeah. I actually heard from his widow that he insisted that the music editor cut his Foley. Because he wanted it perfectly in sync with the music, and I thought that was a brilliant idea.
Yeah,
he walked his own Foley, and then he had his music editor cut it.
Wow,
which just makes perfect
sense.
For
anybody listening, if you haven't seen Patricia Ward Kelly's one woman show about Gene Kelly, it is brilliant.
I
love her. Opens up. I adore her. I interviewed her at TCM a couple times, and I've been to her show twice. I've been, because it's so fascinating with all the information that that she imparts.
Now, she's a dear friend, and she knows about the museum. I'm going to get her oral histories recorded, sound-wise.
And to show, and also too, the fact that Gene Kelly had 103 or 105 degree fever while they were filming
during
that
night. Yeah, when they were shooting that. Yeah, He's a
trooper. I mean, sometimes time constraints are there, and that's, you just have to go forward.
Yeah, and that's something that I think we're losing with the current filmmakers. I hear more and more about, well, something's delayed because somebody is sick, or they don't want to work because they're sick, and you know, you never would have heard that back in the 40s or the 50s.
Yeah.
No, you're under contract. We're shooting. We're working. Suck it up.
Yeah. Well, there was that great story on Raiders of the Lost Ark where Harrison Ford was very, very ill. But he kept shooting as long as he could, and finally, when he was about to just pass out, he told Steven, you know, I can't do this anymore. And it inspired that gag where he shoots the swordsman, because they had a whole fight that they were shooting. They actually started shooting it, and Spielberg says, well, you know, we're going to lose half a day. The only way I can get through it is if you shoot the swordsman. Just joking about it, he said that. But the crew laughed, and he said, hey, that's a great idea. So the last shot Harrison did that day is shooting the swordsman. And you look at him in that shot, he looks like death on a cracker.
Yeah.
He's ready. He went back to his room and went to sleep.
When David was working on Salvador with John Savage and James Woods, they had such a difficult shoot. When they came back, John Savage was not available for ADR. So every single letter of every single word of every single take that John Savage did is right in there. It's the only production sound for him.
Oh, wow.
Oh, that's wild.
Even the gurgle at the end.
Oh, my gosh.
That was recorded on set.
Oh.
Wow.
Yeah, and that's, you know, that's a testament to the dedication of the craft. Not only for the performers, but for the technicians to capture that. You know, there was a time where people didn't figure, oh, I can just fix this later. They actually captured good, solid production sound.
Yeah. It's tough sometimes, though, with no fault of your own, because of the conditions or the special effects or the set is wooden instead of metal or you know, something like that. So there's so many things hindering the process. But if you have a really good production mixer, go in and just do... You know, have access to what he needs or she to do what they need to do. They can do some phenomenal things.
Well, that's like our wonderful friend Paula Fairfield.
Oh yeah,
the mother of dragons.
Yeah,
she's brilliant. Know, Paula did the sound for Hands of Stone with Edgar Ramirez, and to create the cacophony of street noise, she actually went and recorded. Got all these people together, because it's down in Panama, it's so multicultural, multi-ethnic, with all sorts of dialogues, and she recorded all this production sound to use as fill to capture, you know, the sound of people for the street fights, for just the community, And it adds so much, and it sounds so great.
If you have the time or the inclination to do that, it just brings so much more to your to the show.
And it doesn't take that much time.
It really doesn't. Right. People don't get that.
The track.
Sound is like you know, you're moving quickly and you have your recorder and you can capture things really quick. It does not take that much time. It just takes a little bit of effort and ingenuity. And I'm always
playing for it.
I'm always trying to record new things, not even knowing what I will need them for. Just knowing that I have them sort of makes me, you know, feel better. And, you know, building your library is how you move forward.
Yeah. It's funny when Bill Macy and I were talking the other day, we both brought up, because I was record with an H4N recorder when I do interviews.
Yes. Yeah.
Because I get such good radio quality sound, and Bill has that too, and he loves the H4N.
So we
were talking about the Eagle Huntress documentary that came out last year, mm-hmm. shot in Mongolia, the female girl who trained to be an Eagle Huntress in the culture. And there's a sequence where she actually has to climb up this rock face in the steppe lands, and she has to capture an eaglet. And she's going to have that eagle to train.
Oh my gosh.
Well, the director is there. He's shooting, and he wants to get all this. He couldn't drag any equipment up. All he could do was take his H4N to up there to capture the sound. That is the sound in the movie.
But, you know, if you've got a good mic and you do it well, it's fine. And digital, you know, there was a myth back in the day that digital self-resolves to picture. Well, that's not entirely true, but it gets you damn close. So, yeah, in a pinch, you know, you do what you do, and it works.
So, Lisa, will you be coming out for the dedication of the Hollywood Sound Museum?
She better be.
I'm hoping to get out there sooner than later. Just kind of have to see what life brings.
Yeah, absolutely. Now. Well, Lisa, I'm indebted to her, because she is really helping with a lot of the administrative work and a lot of the paperwork and, you know, leaving me to like deal with some of the creative stuff and tracking down artifacts and all that I'm best at. But I'm really indebted to her and her effort she's been making to help the museum become a reality. Because
Steve, as I've always said, you're the cornerstone of all this, because you're making this come to fruition.
Well, that's right.
Thank you.
So that you can save everything for our future people.
Mm-hmm.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
I
will say goodbye. So if anybody else wants to call, they can.
I don't think anyone will.
But Lisa,
I appreciate you calling, dear. Thank you so much.
Take care. Thank
bye-bye.
You.
Bye-bye, dear.
And
Lisa Udall, ladies and gentlemen.
So it's 11:38. Should we?
Oh, yeah, we should talk about sounds and stuff.
Well, no.
Or do you want to? Oh, you want to do the thing? Yeah.
I think we should do the reveal.
For those of you who haven't been watching, there's this sort of black covered thing in front of the screen for the picture for people that
that even warranted me bringing out velvet for the table.
I know, right?
You know, of course, how many people have purple velvet sitting in their house?
Well, do you want me to give the quick? Because
give the quick. And
well,
then
last
we will
week,
reveal.
Last week, if you tuned into the show. We had a call in from my dear friend Lisa Varney.
No, the last time you were here, wasn't last week.
Oh, no, I'm sorry.
It just feels like last week.
Thank you. Last time I was on the show, my dear friend Lisa Varney called in. She is the daughter of the late, great re-recording mixer Bill Varney, who is just a master at the craft and mixed so many wonderful films. And in his incredible career, he won 2 Oscars. One for Empire Strikes Back and one for Raiders of the Lost Ark. Well, Lisa pledged both of Bill's Oscars to the museum to be on display, which was just overwhelming to me. And we're going to do a nice tribute to Bill in the museum, centerpieced around, you know, these Oscars. And just recently, she has sent one of them to us. And this is Bill's Oscar.
I'm closer. Would you like
me to
lift
it? You go ahead and do
it.
This is Bill's. Just lift the thing off. There you go. This is Bill's Oscar from Raiders of the Lost Ark. And
We have it. It is a real live little
Oscar.
Golden boy.
Yeah. Yeah.
It is beautiful.
I'm just still in awe of you know, I wake up every morning and look at that in my shelf, you know, with all the artifacts that are going into the museum, and I'm like, you know, how did I get so lucky to have that pledged to us? And Bill's work is amazing in the film. You know, Ben Burtt, of course, again, one of, you know, we've talked about him.
Mm-hmm.
He created so many of those effects. And Richard Anderson, who called into the show last time I was here, was the supervising sound editor. They have Oscars for this film, too. It's one of the classic film sound jobs ever. And I'm just blown away that we have this as part of the museum.
It's phenomenal. And for those of you that have never seen an Oscar up close, I mean, the detail, I mean, they're beautiful, but also they're all numbered.
Yeah.
You know, there's inscriptions on the back, inscriptions on the front. I'm not picking it up because Steve forgot to bring white gloves and he promised.
Touching it.
And nobody can touch it.
Yeah.
He promised.
A lot of people have been picking it up, and I insist if they do, they wear the white museum gloves because, you know, after a while they lose their
the luster.
Yeah, their shininess. You have to have it replated.
Yes, reshined.
And, yeah, and the Academy will do that for a mere, what, $1,500 or something?
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah, so we're not going to do that.
We're not going to do that, no. And had I known that you were going to forget the white gloves...
Yeah, it's all right.
I have a pair of my mother's old white gloves that are probably 70 years old.
Oh, wow.
I would have brought them.
You go through them pretty quick because they do build, you know, the oils in your hands do go through the gloves eventually, too. I ordered a bunch of them and I just plumb forgot.
He forgot.
So he's just going to sit there and go behind velvet when he goes back into his little
bag. But, you know, and of course, we thought it very appropriate that we have the Oscars sitting in front of Robert Osborne's.
Yeah, there you go.
Our beloved Robert Osborne.
The late, great Robert Osborne.
85 years of Oscar.
Yeah.
Seems rather fitting.
Absolutely.
But this is very exciting.
I'm glad I could bring that because that's one of our big pieces for the museum. I mean, obviously, we're going to have sound libraries. We're going to have collections. We're going to have interactive exhibits. We've already started working on it. I did a live stream on Facebook a couple of weeks ago, and we actually teased some of the...
I love the interactive tease.
Yeah, that's going to be fun because we wanted a way that we can present sound effects to people who come to the museum and sit down and not just, you know, here's a sound effect, here's another sound effect. We wanted to make an interesting kind of tie into the films they were in and the history. So there'll be this whole... sort of touchscreen kind of application that you can, and some of that will be available online too. We'll have a virtual version of the museum online, but if you actually go into the brick and mortar place and sit down at these kiosks that we're going to have, you can access almost the entire collection.
Wow.
Yeah.
How long is it going to take to put that together?
I don't know.
I got to ask you that.
No, I understand. I respect that. We're still figuring that out. I mean, I'm working every day on this. We're digitizing sounds. We're going through stuff. If you follow my personal Facebook page, you'll see I'm posting, you know, these shots of me, you know, going through a vast archive of things and boxes that are like falling apart and tape spewing out of them. And I have to make sense of all this stuff. It's a challenge. And right now it's pretty much just me.
Mm-hmm.
So your contributions will help immensely to make this happen.
Well, and you know, where can people right now make contributions pending the 501c3?
Our GoFundMe page is still active.
Okay.
You can actually go, it's referred to, we have a website, but if you go there, it'll refer you right to the GoFundMe page because we're still working on the web stuff. We're hopeful, hopefully before the end of the year, we'll have a real site. But if you go to hollywoodsoundmuseum.org, which if you're watching on Facebook right now, there should be a link there. But if you go to that site, it'll take you right to the GoFundMe page. And please, you know, anything you can contribute would be immensely helpful. And we'll send you a button. We'll send you a T-shirt with all kinds of premiums.
Yes. And we have lovely buttons.
All kinds
of course,
stuff.
I spent money
on
a T-shirt.
There you go.
Yes, I did.
I saw that. That's great. But and there are higher tiers too, where eventually we'll give you a membership. We'll give you, you know, you can come in whenever you like if you help us this early stage to make it happen.
And of course, you know, as soon as you get the 501c3,
that's going to happen very soon. Lisa, who was just speaking to us, Lisa Udall, is actively making that happen.
No, and I know,
it takes forever.
I know that.
I've been talking about this
forever.
For a year now.
It takes
crazy.
501c3s.
Yeah,
you got to dot the I's, cross the T's for the government.
Oh yeah, we're assembling our board. We're getting
all of our advisory
board. We're having some great, you know, Richard Anderson, who was here, you know, Oscar winner for sound. He's going to be on our advisory board. We've got some great people who've been champions of this for a long time that are going to be a part of it. So
And of course, once that happens, you know, donations are then tax deductible.
Yeah, absolutely. Give you a nice little write-off there.
That's right.
Even for the equipment too, we'll set a monetary amount on it.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I've gotten moviolas, I've gotten all kinds of editing equipment and all these wonderful pieces that, you know, reward the people who contribute to us somehow. That's one of the ways.
Yeah, I think, you know, Pam will probably agree. You know, Nick probably has, station owner Nick Fedorov probably has some audio equipment around here.
Yes, I saw a few things coming. He
might want to dust off.
Well, I recently, the CAS, the Cinema Audio Society, who are the mixers,
mm-hmm.
and the motion picture sound editors, who have the Golden Reel Awards every year, they were very gracious to give us ads in their books. And I made an ad for it. And rather than ask for donations in those ads, I said, you know, anything you wish to contribute. It was really a call. I didn't say it in so many words, but I said, you know, whatever's in your garage or your attic, now's the time to clean them out and see what's there, and let's make them mean something and help educate people.
A call to arms.
Exactly.
Yes.
Exactly.
Well, so
let's talk more about stuff. Here's one other thing I brought. Did you see this?
Yeah.
This is one of the little pocket things. Whenever I go to a party or somebody and something, and they ask, you know, did you bring anything that you can tell the story? This is just a simple pair of dice. Richard Anderson actually bought these on Hollywood Boulevard at the Hollywood Magic Store.
But these are large.
Yeah, these are large dice. And for the radio people, there you are. You can hear them. These are the dice that we bought specifically to use for sound effects for Nightmare Before Christmas, for Oogie Boogie, when he's rolling his dice and, you know, deciding the fate of Jack Skellington and everyone else and Sally and all that.
This is them.
These are the dice that we recorded for him rolling the dice. And although I don't have them anymore, when he would throw them and they would like go in the ear of a skull
mm-hmm.
and rattle around and then come out the other end, I stole my mom's small wooden salad bowls to use.
You know, those were a really
big
thing.
She never got them back, too.
Those were a really big thing
yeah.
in the 70s, the wooden salad bowls.
I had a pair of those and we put them in there and, you know, rattle them around, and that's the sound of the dice and the skulls. But these, I managed to keep the dice, and they were in my desk for many, many years, and I would use these every now and then. There was a trailer we did for some movie. I can't remember what it was. Tommy Lee Jones, you know movies, maybe you remember. Tommy Lee Jones was a mad bomber, and Jeff Bridges was trying to track him down. I can't remember the name
of
it.
Not The Fugitive.
Yeah, no, but anyway, there was a really stylized trailer of this, like, devious Rube Goldberg kind of thing that triggers an explosion, and they had a close-up of marbles. And these fingers come down, extreme close up, and they pick up a marble.
Marble.
And I was working with, I think, Ron Bartlett and a couple of other guys. We were coming up with sound effects for this trailer, and it had to be really big and stylized. And we needed that little close up of marbles clinking together.
Yeah.
And I ran up to my office and I got the dice and whoops. And just use that, just a hint of that for the marbles. And that got in. But these have saved my ass so many times. These dice, but they're going in the museum too.
All right.
They're officially Oogie Boogie's dice. But, you know, all kinds of, I'm like scouring the world looking for things.
And of course, you have sound effects records here.
Yes, this is something you can see them on camera there. If you grab those. This one in particular is neat because whenever they did a live show back in the day, back in the 40s and 50s, and they needed a bunch of sound effects that they couldn't perform, they would actually make records. They'd actually, mm-hmm. you know, carve these, you know, acetate records with the specific sounds they needed. These would be custom made by the radio station. You couldn't get these from a store. And they just assembled the sounds they needed for that particular episode. And so we have a bunch of these that were donated by a friend.
Well, I have some of those that go back to WFIL radio and television in the 40s and 50s.
That's great. Yeah, this came from a station in Chicago. I don't know exactly what it was. But in the 50s, later on, they actually produced commercial sound effects records that you could get.
Such as
these. Yeah, so these guys, yeah. And they're different distributors. That
one's
particularly good. Doctored for super sound.
For super sound.
Yeah.
But in audio fidelity, no less.
Yeah. But these are all in pretty good condition. We got this from an independent collector not too long ago, It's very, very generously donated to us. We're going to digitize all these, and these will be available on those kiosks, so you can look at the cover and actually play them. You know, we're not these. The originals will go away and into storage and be taken care of. But you'll have access to that sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean, and that's something that people don't realize when you're talking about preservation, be it with film, be it with videotape, be it with audio, digital archive preservation, DAP, it's not inexpensive. No. It costs money. Because I know I'm involved with the Broadcast Pioneers in Philadelphia.
Yeah.
That a ton of stuff that my dad had collected over the years, we donated for them to DAP to archive it digitally, but then return it to us.
Right.
So if I can convince my executor brother to get those back, I would, you know, one place has them. Let's share the wealth with another place.
Absolutely.
But it is very costly.
It really is.
Very costly.
It's time consuming and it's costly in the equipment upkeep and all that stuff. Yeah, no, there's a lot of costs involved.
Because you have to have the original equipment that can play the materials.
Now, you touch on something very, very interesting, because I am assembling all that too. You know, we're trying to get all the old DAT machines. You know, it's funny how I'm saying old DAT machines, because I remember when they were new and we copied the library onto them and we had racks and racks of DAT tapes, and that was the new thing. Ooh. And now it's like you can't find one that works anymore when you need it. And so I'm hoping to have two or more of everything so that we can do these kinds of transfers, you know, actively. And other things, like there's the old DA88 machines that had 8 tracks of digital, you know, in a cartridge that was just slightly bigger than a DAT tape. And those were even more finicky than DATs.
Yeah.
And I've got one of those finally, too. I haven't fired it up yet, so hopefully it works. We'll see. But, yeah, just tracking down all these things so you can do transfers and archive it and make it available.
Yeah, because if you don't have the original equipment to play the stuff, to play it on, there is no way you can do any transfers.
Yeah. Well, even quarter-inch machines, the tapes are getting all gummy and you have to bake the tapes. I was just discussing that with a friend online. The company I was with for many years, we actually invented a sort of a sweat box for tapes. We made a big black box and you'd heat it up with professional hair dryers that we would stick in there and just heat up the air. So, because the biggest problem was if you just stick it in the oven and you forgot about it, you suddenly had this heap of plastic. Yeah. Yeah. They found that out several times at some of the studios, very tragically. But we figured if we just use hot air, you can get it really, really hot. And you put a thermometer in there to monitor it and put it in there for a few hours and it'll play great. It basically, the adhesive on some of the brands of tape seeped into the magnetic side, and it was impossible to play without it getting gummed up. And this somehow brought it back to life for a day or two, so you could make your transfers and then put it back. And that's the thing. We're saving all the masters. We're not throwing them away.
Right.
That's one of the things that the studio is doing that prompted this whole thing about the museum, is so many of the actual masters, the original tapes, are just gone.
And
toss. And they're as important as, you know, the recordings themselves. So we're saving those and putting them away, and, you know, on a shelf where they can be worshipped.
Yeah. and the thing is, anybody who, you know, you really do worship things like this, because, you know, with everything becoming so digitized now and in a virtual world, that it's the tangible nature of where the industry started, the tangible nature of recording.
Absolutely.
The tangible nature of film, television. And you do worship and you treat the stuff with kid gloves, because it's part of our heritage. It's part of it has helped shape the world.
Yeah. Well, it's like the last time I was here, I had those tapes, master tapes from Raiders.
Yeah.
And you were looking at the handwritten log, and it's like that was there from the ingestion of the sound, and there's important information there that doesn't necessarily get translated.
Mm-hmm.
And people write in their own little notes. And, you know, working at the company that I did, there were 3 owners. And
At Weddington?
Yeah, over at Old Weddington. And Mark Mangini, Steve Fleck, and Richard Anderson. And each of them sometimes there'd be handwritten notes. And so you got to learn each of their handwriting so you could see who wrote this in. You know, Stephen had a very big all caps kind of way. And Richard had sort of a sloppy sort of handwritten thing. And Mark Mangini had this neat little printed thing that he would do, and you'd recognize, and you'd hear the conversation in your head when you saw the notes from each of them.
Well, I think I may have mentioned to you, that's one of the coolest things, that because my dad had all these 45s that were played on American Bandstand.
Oh, wow.
Because he was a cameraman for Bandstand.
Oh, that's neat.
Back when it was at 46 and Market Street.
Yeah.
And
they actually played 45s on the show?
Yeah.
That's wild.
But a lot of these, and because they were in conjunction, it was Walter Annenberg owned the station at the time. It was WFIL, AM, FM, and television. Mm-hmm. And so they got a lot of stuff also to play on the radio for promotion. And my dad had just rows of this stuff in the basement. And my brother packaged it all up, shipped it all to me. You don't want to know what the FedEx bill was.
Oh, my God, yeah.
But I had to have a cabinet custom made to put stuff in. But as I start looking through it, there are all these handwritten notes on the record sleeve, on the 45 sleeves.
Yeah.
There are the steel, the aluminum records that most people have never seen or heard of.
Yeah.
And there are handwritten notes in there, or notes from who sent the sound effect, or who sent. And that is half the
That's
fun.
That's great stuff,
Is looking at all of that.
Well, the boxes, too, of these tapes would have different things on them, too. So you'd... And it never got, added to the metadata or anything like that.
Yeah.
So I'm thrilled to have some of those tapes. A lot of them got thrown away from Old Weddington, but I saved a few dozen. I saved them from the trash. So.
Anything that can get saved.
Yeah, absolutely. Ben Burt still has all of his Star Wars tapes. Yeah. All the old. He made all those on an old 4-track TIAC machine, which I have the same model in my collection. I just found it too. I thought it was lost. Found it in my stash. It was wrapped up by my movers, and I didn't recognize it. It was just with other boxes.
Yeah.
But I opened it up the other day. But it's the same model that he used. It was just a 1/4-inch 4-track machine. Mm-hmm. And he still has all those old masters.
Yeah.
So they're little nuggets of history.
Well, and it's just like lobby cards. The sets of, set of 8 lobby cards that used to be come out with
films. Each film, yeah.
They're a thing of the past.
Pretty much. Yeah.
And my good friend Neil Summers, stuntman, he also has the largest collection of Hollywood Western memorabilia.
Oh, wow.
And Neil has the largest collection of lobby cards.
Oh, that's neat. Yeah, those are great.
And I know a lot of that he has donated to, a lot of his stuff is on display in the Autry Museum.
Oh, that's a great place for it.
But I may have to bother somebody and maybe get, share the well.
Exactly.
So, Pam.
Hey, Pam. We're just looking at the time here and wondering...